Hello and welcome to Saving Animals with Blank Park Zoo. I'm Ryan Bickle. On today's show, we have Bridie Nixon, who is an instructor with Drake University and a PhD student up at Iowa State University and a bat expert. So first time we've had a bat expert on the show.
And just wanted to make sure people heard it's a bat expert, not a bad expert.
Yeah. Yes. I have trouble pronouncing.
Bridie, we're really excited to have you on the show today. Welcome.
Thank you. I'm really excited to be here.
So I'm Jessie Lowry, the Director of Conservation and Research here at the zoo, and I like to take the first couple minutes and set the stage. Blank Park Zoo is what I call a window to the wild, a place where we can invite the community to come in and see the amazing animals that we have here at the zoo. We've got snow leopards and tigers and giraffe and rhinos and hornbills and snakes and a really diverse collection of endangered animals here to see. And we want people to have a fun, affordable day out. We've surveyed our audience. We know that's what they're looking for. But while they're here, we want to encourage and incite some kind of behavior change, some kind of conservation action that's actually going to make a difference in the environment and to wildlife populations all over the world. And so some of the simple actions that we encourage is planting of butterfly gardens through Plant Grow Fly. Butterflies and bees are important to our global food system and ecosystems across the earth, and what they need is native plants, and native plants are good for every other kind of animal that is native to Iowa as well. We encourage people to be as green as possible because especially our use of single-use plastics has a direct impact on not just marine wildlife, but all kinds of wildlife. As a zoo, we have an audience of 500,000 people a year. And so we've got such a great opportunity to really get these messages out. And the mission of Blank Park Zoo is to inspire an appreciation of the natural world through conservation, education, research, and recreation. But we want people to walk out of our doors knowing exactly what they can do to help save wildlife. And an important point to make as well is that just by visiting the zoo, you're helping to save wildlife, because a portion of every dollar that we make goes to save animals in the wild. So your money goes to International Rhino Foundation, helping to save rhinos in every country in which they exist, to the Tiger Conservation Campaign in Russia, saving Amur tigers, of which there's only 540 left in the wild. And to Hornbill Research Foundation in Thailand. And so it's really great to know that the community is helping us make these great strides all over the world to help save animals. But if you want to get the most bang for your buck, if you really want to do something that's going to have a huge impact, taking care of your local environment is really the way to go. We mentioned Plant Grow Fly. Bridie has been really involved in Plant Grow Fly since its beginning in 2013. We also have a program called Upcycle, where we remove invasive plant species from local parks, helping to give room for these native plants to grow. We've helped pass the turtle bill a couple years ago, creating a protective season for four species of Iowa turtles. And I know that Bridie's very passionate about Iowa's species of wildlife. And Ryan, when we were thinking about prospective guests for this show, I always remember this awesome presentation that Bridie did, I don't know, 5-6 years ago?
It was a few years ago. I'm really impressed that you remember.
Yeah. And she did a presentation, a lunch and learn for staff and volunteers on bats.
Yeah, I was there.
Yes. Yeah. And don't you remember how great it was?
It was great.
It was great. She's a wealth of knowledge on many different animals in Iowa. But that presentation, she's one of those cool biologists, and she's one of those people that can make biology fun, and especially an animal very close to my heart, the bat. I was a zookeeper for 9 years, and I got to take care of the Egyptian fruit bats. They're just puppies with wings. They're just puppies with wings, with a very important ecological service that they provide us.
And also my favorite superhero.
Great, great.
Batman. Yeah.
Apparently, my 4-year-old daughter just told me that I'm going to be Batgirl for Halloween, so that's great. Looking forward to that. As I was a zookeeper and I would be inside the exhibit, hosing out or feeding the animals, so often, people would squeal and run through the bat cave and act like they were afraid. And it just tore my heart out. These are such amazing animals. And of course, Egyptian fruit bats are so different from the bats that we have here in Iowa. And we'll talk about that. But I love to tell the story of bats and how important they are. So again, Bridie, welcome to the show. And we're so excited to have you here today.
Well, I love talking about bats, so this is the perfect opportunity for me to do that. I could go on forever, so you'll have to stop me at some point. But
fantastic. Talk a little bit about yourself as we get started here, Bridie. What are you doing at Drake? And you're a PhD candidate at Iowa State. Tell us about what you're doing now.
Right. Well, I teach biology at Drake. I teach a lot of the freshman labs. So we're, you know, seeing students when they come in and they're just starting to go on their path to becoming future pharmacists, and a lot of them studying different parts of the human medicine. And so I try to get a little bit of ecology and environmental science in there, since that's my background. But and then I'm also studying at Iowa State University, and I'm studying otters and bobcats up there. So I've taken kind of a little shift out of bats, but it's not as unrelated as one might think. They've got a lot in common. So, yeah, just looking at more of Iowa's species and how we can best keep an eye on their population numbers and make sure that they're doing okay.
So Ryan and I's ears just perked up because we know that now we're going to have you back for another show so you can talk about otters and bobcats.
Fantastic. Great.
Okay, so let's talk about bats.
Yes.
Please tell us what got you passionate about bats and, you know, what kind of bats we have here in Iowa.
Okay, well, Jesse and Ryan, I have a little bit of a confession. When I started studying bats, I was just recently finished with my undergraduate degree. I was looking for a master's. I knew I wanted to go to Louisiana and study mammals, and this was the project that had funding. And so, as a lot of researchers will tell you, sometimes you just study where the money is. And when I started studying bats, I have to confess, I was a little nervous. Like, I was a little frightened to be around them. But I kind of had a trial by fire where there was an abandoned building where there were about 10,000 bats. And there were two chimneys that the bats could emerge every night. And we basically had a funnel of like tarp over PVC pipe, which would funnel 10,000 bats directly at me while I held it trapped to catch some of them. And once I realized what it was like to work around bats and how amazing they were, and once I started to learn about them, that fear completely went away, and I've just been fascinated by them since then and just totally in love with bats ever since that experience.
That sounds like such an amazing experience. Yeah. And such a wonderful place to get your master's degree. I just took a vacation to New Orleans, and Louisiana is such a beautiful, beautiful place. So I can only imagine what that, even for a person who loves bats, to have 10,000 bats coming at you, I'm sure you definitely were just put right into the fire. So tell us a little bit about, you know, Iowa bats, and what kind of species do we have here, and what are their population status?
Right. So, you know, Iowa isn't always a place that people think about when you think of native wildlife and lots of animals, but we do have 9 species of bats. If you are to find a bat maybe in your backyard or in your house, you are probably looking at either the big brown bat or the little brown bat. And I know those are very creatively named, but that is what they are called, and that is an example of their size. But we also have pretty commonly a red bat, a hoary bat, and a silver-haired bat. And so those 5 species are our most common in Iowa. And our red, hoary, and silver-haired bats are all kind of pretty, if you think of a bat as pretty. They have sort of a silver-colored collar on them. And the hoary bat especially has like frosted wheats, that they have a silver-tipped fur along the back. So they kind of look like a frosted wheat. Mm-hmm. Now, our less common bats would be the Indiana bat, which is federally endangered. And so that's our only species in Iowa that's actually federally endangered, is the Indiana bat. And you may have heard about that if you're from around Blank Park Zoo, if you're from around the Des Moines area. A few years ago, there was a construction project held up in Waukee because an Indiana bat was found. So it caused a lot of headaches out there in Waukee because they had to stop the construction project because of an Indiana bat. But we have 3 other species, the evening bat, the eastern pipistrelle, or the tricolored bat, and then my personal favorite, as I am a little bit biased, but the northern long-eared bat, or the northern long-eared myotis, which is federally threatened, but not endangered.
I had no idea that we had so many species. Tell us what ecosystem services bats provide. Why should we love bats?
Well, locally, our bats do a lot as far as agriculture. They actually can save us over $1 billion a year. So that's been very helpful for our farmers. They do a lot as far as eating pests. So one of the pests that they really enjoy eating is the corn earworm moth. And the corn earworm moth not only eats corn, but also tomatoes and watermelon and cotton. And their larvae cause a lot of damage to those plants. So as bats emerge every night and eat some of those insects, they're actually saving us a lot of money in crop loss, and they're saving us a lot of money in applying pesticides as well. And of course, saving our environment in some way because we can apply fewer pesticides. So locally, they do a lot as far as agriculture, and they also eat a lot of mosquitoes, which, you know, yeah, we don't really want around anyway. So those are some of the services they provide.
It would be interesting to find out exactly how they quantified, you know, how much bats help us with especially those agricultural pests.
Right. Yeah. I don't know if they can do a survey. I don't think the bats would answer that. But.
Okay. So they're really important to agriculture. They're important to decreasing mosquitoes, which are not just annoying to humans, but also carry diseases.
Right. Yeah.
What is making them more rare, especially the two that are vulnerable and endangered?
They're facing a lot of risks that I think are pretty universal among wildlife right now, including climate change and loss of habitat. Those are pretty universal things that are challenges for any species of wildlife. Specific to bats, they are also facing some challenges that come along with wind turbines, which can be a little surprising because we consider wind turbines to be environmentally really good. But they definitely are facing some challenges with those, and then also with a disease called white nose syndrome. This is a disease that's caused by a fungus called P. destructans, so a very serious name for a very little fungus. But basically, it's attacking the bats while they're hibernating, waking them up from their hibernation, and then causing them to not have enough water and electrolyte imbalances and use up a lot of energy and potentially starve to death. So, yeah, these little guys are in no shortage of things that are in their way right now and reasons why they're in decline.
And tell us a little bit more about white nose syndrome. I've read some articles, just like you said, they are supposed to be hibernating, but instead they kind of wake up and burn through all of their energy. I went hiking at Maquoketa Caves several years ago, and there was a lot of literature there about cleaning your shoes and things before you went into the cave. So was it always in Iowa? Why has it become such a problem now?
Sure. And, you know, I've seen that at Maquoketa Caves also. It's a wonderful place to go and hike. And I think that was maybe the first spot where it was detected in Iowa. White nose syndrome has actually, it didn't originate here in America. It's a fungus that's been around tens of thousands of years. And bats in Eurasia and Europe probably evolved with it. So they're actually maybe have some kind of immunity or resistance to it. But it's fairly new to North America. It was first detected here in 2006 in New York. And it's spread eastward since then. So now it's past the Mississippi. It's west of the Mississippi. There's even been detected in Washington. And I remember a few years ago, there were some scientists projecting, well, it won't make it west of the Rocky Mountains. Well, I guess so. So it's been spreading throughout the United States and Canada, and it's killed at least 5 million bats. That's probably a conservative estimate. And between public and private spending, we spent over $50 million so far trying to combat this disease because of what I mentioned before, that bats are so important to our agriculture and our pest control. We do want to spend the money trying to stop this disease in its path and try to limit the damage that it's causing.
So speaking of diseases, let's talk a little bit about why people don't like bats. Of course, they're nocturnal, and some of the bats, even though I'm very partial, when you see their little faces, they look a little scary. And, you know, it's just in the dark and you can't see them. And so I get that part. But let's talk a little bit about some of the diseases that bats could possibly be the host for.
I think the big one that comes to mind, of course, is rabies. A lot of people assume that most bats carry rabies, or if you touch a bat, you will get rabies. Most bats don't have rabies. It's actually fairly rare, maybe under 5% of bats worldwide are going to carry rabies. But with that said, because it is such a serious disease, if you find a bat that isn't acting normal, if it's on the ground, if it seems to be in distress, make sure that you have somebody who's a professional or who knows how to handle a bat, maybe put that bat somewhere where it's safe. But in general, if you come across a bat and it's just doing its normal bat thing, you are probably not in danger. But again, because it's such a serious disease, we always say, well, be cautious first. But most bats are fairly healthy.
So, you know, that takes us right into another subject that I think is commonly a question commonly asked. If you find a bat in your home, what should you do?
A lot of people have that question. And I think a lot of people will have that question actually around August or September. The reason being that most of our mother bats here around Iowa are going to have their pups right around, maybe around this time of year, maybe May or June. It takes them about 3 weeks to fly. So not too long after that, they start going out onto their own, as you know, young people do, and leave the, not the nest, but leave the roost. And they'll find themselves going into attics and barns and garages because they're kids and they don't know any better yet. So around August or September, they will kind of end up places where they shouldn't be. The best thing to do is to call a professional to remove the bat. I would say that most bats are protected unless they are in a human structure. So bat protections do not necessarily extend to bats in your home. Although as a bat lover, I don't recommend doing anything too drastic to get the bat out of the house. One thing, if you can look at your house at night, if you see where the bats are emerging, so you get out there and just kind of watch them as they come out at dusk, if you can pinpoint where that entrance is into your home and then maybe put a piece of plastic pipe or maybe a PVC pipe or something with, it sounds a little weird, but put a pantyhose on the end of it. Because what that will allow the bat to do, if there are any pups or any bats still in your home, they can get out. But then as that pantyhose collapses, they can't get back in. So if you can picture that kind of a pipe or something covering up that point of emergence on your home, and then something like a pantyhose that will collapse outside of it so the bats can't re-enter, but can still get out in case anyone's still trapped inside.
And so as far as catching the bat inside, I grew up in a house that is over 100 years old, and I would say just about every year, we would wake up in the middle of the night and see something swooping through our bedrooms.
Right.
And so we'd all scream, and Dad would come out, and he would just get, like, he'd put gloves on and just get, like, a coffee can and try to kind of trap it. It was usually hanging in the curtain somewhere.
Sure.
Trap it against the wall and try to get it outside. Is that kind of what you recommend?
That's what I would recommend. Leave the tennis racket down. Wear some really thick gloves just to make sure you are protected from any bites, because they will be scared. But if you can trap the bat in something, even something like a pillowcase or a coffee can or a bucket or anything, when you put the bat outside, make sure that you put it up off the ground, because bats actually have trouble flying from the ground. They need to drop off of something so they can swoop. So put them on something, even if they can just get a couple of inches of height before they start to fly. That would be good.
So we know what species of bats we have. We know how important they are to our ecosystem, and we know that they're declining. Right. Let's talk about what they need in Iowa. What kind of habitat, what kind of, what do they need to survive and to start to thrive again?
Right. Well, we mentioned the Maquoketa Caves, and a lot of people in North America would consider caves when they're thinking about bat habitat, or bat-a-tat, as I like to call it. But trees are also really important. And some of the trees that are important are actually trees that have died. So we look at a snag or a dead tree and think, well, that's maybe a danger. You don't want that to fall on your house, or you don't want that to fall on a trail. But these snags are really important for bats because they can access a lot of sunlight. Their temperature control is really important. So as they're sleeping during the day, if the tree doesn't have leaves on it, it's a great way for them to stay warm and control their temperature. So it's not just a dead tree. It's actually really important habitat. Another thing that people can do is to put bat boxes on their property. So a bat box, if you're interested in one of those, I would recommend looking at Bat Conservation International. Not only do they have some instructions if you want to make your own, which could be a great family activity for your kids over the summer, but they also have some ideas about where to buy one if maybe you're like me and you're not quite as handy when it comes to woodworking. But these bat boxes you can install on trees around your home. You just want to put them about 10 feet up in the air to make sure that you're avoiding any predators. They can be a really nice part of your house. You can paint them different colors and decorate them and make it part of the scenery in your backyard, as well as get yourself a little built-in mosquito control.
We have a bat box. We have not put it up yet, but you would recommend putting it on a tree and probably not on the house or on a shed or a garage. Is that right?
Right. The bats are going to be more likely to use them if they're on a tree or a freestanding pole or something away from your house. Also, if you can get the box so that it is in a little bit of direct sunlight, that would be good, especially in a colder climate as we get, you know, northern into Iowa, Minnesota, and northern. And you also want to paint them a darker color at this latitude up north, and maybe a lighter brown color in the south. So there's a lot of different things that you can do to make sure the bats in your area would prefer your bat box and give them just another place that they can live, as we might be removing a lot of trees and habitats they would use otherwise.
So we have a couple animal care interns currently making bat boxes to put up around the zoo.
Oh, great.
And I just talked to a zookeeper yesterday, and we were talking about potential places to install them. And perhaps you'd be available to kind of consult with the team, and we could walk
absolutely
around the zoo and see where some good spots would be.
Yeah, it sounds like a lot of fun.
Okay.
Yeah.
Fantastic.
Now, will the bats actually hibernate in these boxes?
Generally, that might not be as great for hibernation, but what they could be really good for would be mother bats who are looking to have their pups and keep their pups somewhere in the early summer. So it might be a good replacement for a lost maternity tree or a maternity roost. And so those, even though these boxes, if you've seen one, they don't seem very large, but they could fit up to 40 or 50 bats easily.
Wow.
Yeah, if they're really crammed in there. Of course, every once in a while, you'll get the one lone bachelor male bat who takes up residence. But, you know, it's important for him, too. He can run it.
So where will bats hibernate in the wintertime?
Right. So a lot of them do prefer caves or abandoned buildings, abandoned mines, a barn, a garage that's not used often. And that's one of the things that makes bats so vulnerable, is you'll have many, many bats in the same house or mine or cave, wherever. So if something happens to that one hibernaculum, something bad can happen to all of those bats. And that's one of the reasons why they're just in trouble.
So take us through kind of the life cycle of a bat. We were talking a little bit about hibernation and about when they have pups. Just kind of take us through the annual cycle of a bat in Iowa.
Sure. Okay. So the pups are going to be born, as I said, around early summer. It'll take them about 3 weeks to learn how to fly. When they're born, they're very good about holding onto things with their feet, and they're very good about climbing with their thumbs. And those are the two skills that they're born with. So they're able to hold on to mom, they're able to hold on to a wall. And then in about a month's time, they're going to start to depend less on mom. Towards the end of summer, as I said, they'll merge as young adults and go off into the world. And in the fall, that's when the bats will actually mate. So you'll find the male and female bats spending a lot more time together. And female bats have this really cool thing called delayed implantation, where the mating will actually happen in the fall. But because in the winter, you know, the bats' system is really going to slow down. If they go into torpor, which you can kind of think of as hibernation light, their heart rate will slow down to 10 beats a minute. The body temperature might go down to about 40 degrees Fahrenheit. The immune system's lowered, this is not a good time to be pregnant. So the female bat will wait until the spring, till she wakes up again, she's out of that torpor, she's got insects available to eat, and then will take the material from mating last season and actually become pregnant at that time. So all of that is stored, so that way she's knows she has the best genetic material for her babies. And I think this is just a really cool technique to get around this winter season of hibernation and low resources, and that way she's ready to then have her pups in the spring and we start all over again.
What are some natural predators of bats?
So raccoons can be one. You know, raccoons can be a predator of just about anything. And if bats, especially young bats, fall to the ground wherever they're staying during the day, they can definitely be gobbled up by snakes or by raccoons or other little mid-sized carnivores. So a lot of generalists.
I can't believe we almost forgot to talk about echolocation. Let's talk about how bats communicate.
Sure. Bats are actually in an arms race with all of their insect prey, that they are releasing echolocation. There's this myth that bats are blind. Well, bats, no, they're not actually blind, but no, they don't really depend on their eyes to hunt. So they're emitting noise that's going to bounce back and then tell them where the prey is. But what I find is really neat about echolocation is that moths and other bat prey are learning to avoid it and kind of learning to scramble it. And so then the bat has to get better at making sure the moth can't scramble its call. And then the moth has to get better at making sure that the bat can't find it. So that's why I call it an arms race, that they're constantly getting better at echolocating, and then their prey is constantly getting better at avoiding detection by that echolocation.
And how exactly do they scramble that call?
Oh, I don't know. We're going to have to get a moth expert to tell us more about that.
That is really interesting. I saw something about that on a PBS documentary a few weeks ago and thought that was super interesting as well.
Yeah.
I think we just got a couple minutes left. Tell us quickly about some experiences with your field research with bats.
Oh, sure. Well, a lot of people ask, well, how do you actually study bats or how would you catch them? There's a couple of different ways that you can study bats. If you don't want to handle them, which, you know, with the threats that they're currently facing and a lot of problems they're facing, maybe you don't want to be too intrusive, is to actually use a thermal cam, and you can see the thermal imprint as they emerge and just kind of watch their body heat, and you can count them or measure activity that way. Another way could be just by using the acoustics, because bats are very chatty. They're very talkative. They, even though we were just talking about echolocation, they do have kind of little barks and they yell at each other a lot. So we can look at the acoustic activity of a tree or a cave and use that to measure activity. We can also capture them by hand if we need to, and there's a couple different ways to do that. What I've used the most is a mist net. The mist net is just a very fine net that you can string up between a couple of trees, and you kind of want it where the tree has a canopy, maybe over a nice little stream, so the bats will fly directly into the net as they maybe come down to look at insects around the stream. And if you can imagine it, it's probably about, you know, a 5 or 6 foot wide net. And then about every foot, there's a little pocket that as the bat runs into the net, they will drop into that pocket and then get tangled, at which point the researcher, whoever, will come over and remove it and harass it. And the bat will be very upset and you get the data you need and then you can let it go. But that's really interesting in you know, in southern Louisiana, where I did most of my field work, because in those streams are also a lot of cottonmouths and, you know, a lot of other animals that, you know, maybe we want to avoid. But it was really exciting, but it was really worth it to do and to get to study bats and be around them.
Bridie, thank you so much for being a Blank Park Zoo volunteer for so many years, helping us out with Plant Girl Fly and sharing your expertise today about bats. We really appreciate you being here today.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me.
And if you want to learn more about Blank Park Zoo, go to our website at blankparkzoo.com and check out all our fun social media pages like YouTube and Facebook as well. That's all the time we have for today, so join us next time for Saving Animals with Blank Park Zoo.